Okay, hello and welcome. Where are we? Episode 23 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, a film that both of us here have been anticipating talking about. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I'm Jerry Shario, and I say both of us because the other guy here is an actor, director, musician, playwright, composer, co-author of the book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, which kind of is the reason for this whole thing. A man who is so unaccustomed to public speaking that he thought a Toastmaster was a kitchen appliance. Here is Nick Santamaria.
I'm just popping up now. And boy, am I toasted.
Hey!
Oh, So, Jerry, how are you, buddy? It's good to see you.
I'm doing well, sir. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, sir. Well, sir. Yeah, I'm doing well. Things are good. Things are happy. We are talking about a movie that makes us both very happy.
Yes.
And that opening theme song is just, it was the harbinger of all that's to come. We are just over the moon about this movie, as we should be. If you are a lover of comedy, not just classic comedy, not just horror comedy, but comedy in general, it just transcends all ages, races. In my book, in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, we always have a quotation under the chapter heading, and it's about the chapter that's to follow. And in this one, it was written in Korean. And basically, the story was that I actually took a videotape. That's how old this was. A videotape when I was a comedian on the cruise ships. And I got permission to use the movie theater after midnight one night. And I invited the Korean crew to come and watch Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in English. You never heard such laughter. It was just wonderful. They surrounded me afterwards. You said, oh, that was so, in Korean, that was so funny. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. It transcends all of that, language, race, age. Just it's just a great, great film. I know I'm Mr. Hyperbole, but I say it in the book. You know, Chaplin had City Lights. Keaton had The General. Harold Lloyd killed Clyde Bruckman. But... But Abbott and Costello, their legacy will be this film. And
oh, yeah.
It's already started to be that. You know, this is the movie everyone talks about, except Matthew Conium, my co-author. It fascinates me. It just fascinates me. He just doesn't like this movie. He thinks it turned them into a kiddie act, you know, watching two grown men getting scared at pretend monsters and running away just isn't funny, you know, all of this mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think you're getting the idea that we like this film.
Yeah. No, I hope they're getting that idea too. And, you know, one of my favorite stories related to this film, it's the story of when Gene Wilder had the idea for doing Young Frankenstein, and mm-hmm. he approached Mel Brooks with this idea. Mel Brooks' knee-jerk reaction was, comedy horror, been done. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Can't do any better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
So to me, that's a very high recommendation.
It certainly is. And he often said that Lou Costello did the best scare take in the business,
yep.
Which was true. That's the other film that some people say is the best horror comedy of all time, is Young Frankenstein. I'll tell you why it's not. And everybody yep. listen up here. basically, Young Frankenstein was a very good movie. It's very atmospheric. It's done with love, you can tell, mm-hmm. for the genre. The problem with Mel Brooks's movies with me in general is that every single character is funny. Every single character is winking at the camera, making faces, and doing goofy stuff. Whereas Abbott and Costello were working with a true threat. There was more at stake, so much more at stake, because they played the monsters serious. They played it as if it were a regular Universal monster film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so beloved. You've got two amazing genres You know, you had Abbott and Costello during the 40s supporting Universal, but also supporting Universal were those monster movies that they were putting out that Val Lewton at RKO was making fun of. and so he made his movies with implications rather than, you know, full on monsters. But both are good, actually. But anyway, so you had this beloved genre of the monsters, the Universal monsters, and Abbott and Costello. And what a genius idea that is. Okay, so let's look at the story behind the story. First of all, in 1943, it's said that Bud and Lou came up with an idea to do a Broadway show. They missed performing for live audiences, although they've been doing radio for a long time at this point. But this is the story, and I'm not sure whether I believe it or not. I know it's one of those things where there's no proof. Okay. So their idea was to do a Broadway show, which would include the Universal Monsters. Now, sounds like a cute idea. It's not practical at all because that makeup at the time took about 6 hours to apply. and Lou actually, you know, was not the healthiest guy in the world to do 8 shows a week on Broadway. So I really don't, it might've been something they tossed around or mentioned, but I don't see it being a serious consideration. But it was the first indication that they knew this would be a great combination. So fast forward, of course, the producer, Robert Arthur, back again with the boys, claims it was his idea, like he does every other idea. he says he was talking to Ed Mule, the guy who actually took over Universal at one point, and they came up with the idea. How about the boys with the monsters? And they want Costello's brain and blah, blah, blah. Well, let's go back to 1947, the year before. First, they gave it to Oscar Brodny, writer, and they didn't like anything that he did, and his version of the story doesn't survive. But I do want to give you, I'm going to read a little bit from Bob Furmanek's and Ron Palumbo's amazing book, Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. And I'm only reading from them because they tell the story, whereas I kind of gloss over it in our book. So here it is. Universal went to a guy named Bertram Millhauser. He was a veteran of writing the Sherlock Holmes movies for Basil and Nigel, and he delivered a treatment in February 1947. It was a 47-page treatment. Now, here it is. Ready? It doesn't revolve around filching Costello's brain. Instead, the sinister Dr. Fell steals Dr. Frankenstein's formula for reanimating the monster, Dracula, and the Wolfman from the Baroness von Frankenstein. The dormant monsters are on exhibit in a New York museum where Fell is curator. The Baroness alerts her granddaughter, who, along with an FBI agent, Dan Barlow, waits for Fell to arrive by ocean liner. But Fell is tipped off by a cablegram and hides the formula in a matchbook, which he gives to two stewards from the ship, Abbott and Costello. So they're told to carry the matchbook off the ship and rendezvous with him later at the museum. Okay, a lot of the story revolves around them losing the matchbook. So this is the weird part. They raid the museum's kitchen when they're going to get the, you know, the three bodies. And apparently, they concoct a meal of baked beans, salt, and vinegar. At the same time, Fell reads that salt and vinegar will revive the monster, and baked beans will reanimate the Wolfman. As for Dracula, Lou sees that a table isn't level, so he takes the steak out of Dracula and puts it under the leg of the table, and that brings Dracula around. Oy. Okay. At the last minute, the Baroness arrives with a remedy. They spray the three monsters with an atomizer and they shrink to 4 inches tall. They arrest Dr. Fell and the Baroness permits Bud and Lou to exhibit the tiny creatures on Broadway. But she warns them, you must never, ever let them come in contact with olives. On opening night, Lou eats a deli sandwich backstage and on his plate are three olives. Do you think we'd be celebrating this movie today had they had brain damage enough to shoot that story? that's incredible. I know. I knew you had to hear that because it's just unbelievable. So they decided not to use that.
Good.
And they went with our dream team of Fred Rinaldo, Robert Lees, and John Grant. Mm-hmm. Now, I will confess that John Grant had a little less to do in this movie because it was not a typical Abbott and Costello movie with the routines. They only had a couple of the routines, and they were kind of adjusted for the movie. Now, this turned out to be the Universal Studios' second cheapest movie, least expensive movie of the year.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
With those monsters and the special effects and all that. Wow.
And all of that. It was made for $792,270. And it was over budget by about $30,000. They went a week over budget.
Wow.
But you know how much it made? $3.2 million. And it put them right back in the top 10 at box office again. They were
nice.
They were gone for a few years, and then boom, this movie just shoots them to the top. Production began February 5th, 1948, and it opened in June the same year. So their box office was slipping slightly. This brought them right back up. Bill Getz,
who runs Universal International,
apparently he hated Bud and Lou. He didn't find them funny. He never watched the films. He was a first-class snob. Mm-hmm. And since Metro dropped them in 1945, and Camel, at this point, dropped their radio show, this time around, 47, Getz kind of looked at them as has-beens at this point. You know, they were losing ground. Well, he had a surprise coming, because once this movie was previewed, it was called the best preview Abbott and Costello ever had. People were throwing babies in the air. You know, it was just, it was a celebratory thing in every single way. So yeah, it has a wonderful, it just has a wonderful happy ending. You know, I'm very, very happy about it. It gave them a whole new lease on life in their movie career because it started the trend of them meeting monsters. And everybody loved to see them get scared. So interesting time for this. Universal had let go of a bunch of their stars, their stalwarts, in 1945 and 46. Lon Chaney Jr. was coming back as the Wolfman, but as a freelancer. He was coming back to his old studio. As far as casting, we could also talk about Bela Lugosi, who, as far as I'm concerned, is second to Bud and Lou as the thing to watch in this film.
Yeah.
He's just incredible, and he rallies. He's 66 years old at this point. And this is only the second time he's playing Count Dracula in a film, but it's also his last somewhat big budget film. The rest was all Poverty Row and Ed Wood. Not Deadwood, Ed Wood.
Yeah.
Although, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
But anyway, back in 1947, when they were considering this film, Bela was not in the mix. It was Ian Keith they wanted, who coincidentally was also the front runner for the original Dracula. He was one of the front runners. So was, who did I hear? Was it Lou Ayres? It was really weird casting they were thinking about. Yeah. But anyway, Bela signed on 3 weeks before shooting began. And that was with, you know, letter writing and, you know, hey, I'm still alive, you know, that kind of thing. But boy, does he come through. So anyway, let's talk about the opening credits. Okay. This is something I feel like we broke the news in our book, thanks to my friend Jerry Beck, who is the animation expert of all time. I went to him and asked, because everybody thinks, including Gregory Mank, who does the commentary on the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein Blu-ray, everybody thinks it's Walter Lantz because he produced the Woody Woodpecker cartoons and Andy Panda and all of those for Universal.
Yeah.
But apparently, according to Jerry Beck, they were on the outs for those 2 years, like 47, 48, around that time. And a guy who did freelance work for Universal, not just for opening credit sequences, but for like coming attractions, trailers, and all that stuff. If there was any animation involved, they called Dave Fleischer, Max Fleischer's brother.
Yeah.
And he was the one responsible for the opening credits, that wonderful animation.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. It really is. You know, this time watching it, looking forward to the opening credits, and I was laboring under the misapprehension, it's Universal, must be Walter Lantz. But this time, as I'm watching, it struck me that that's not his style.
Mm-mm. No.
Just to look at it, you can say, no, that's not Walter Lance.
Right.
And then and then I went back and reread your chapter and went, oh, okay, there we go.
There he is. Yeah, it's Dave. And the characters are kind of rubbery, you know, like Dave did.
Yep.
And then the whole, the monsters walking in silhouette along that hillside in the moonlight. Oh, and then the beautiful Lenore Auber walking by. You know, this movie, I think if I had to choose one movie to represent my childhood and the joy of my childhood, it would be this movie. This movie was, along with The Wizard of Oz and even Jack and the Beanstalk with Abbott and Costello, and also like Laurel and Hardy and Babes in Toyland and those kind of things. It was an event movie. Everything stopped. You turned on the TV and you watched. I remember getting in trouble once with my dad. He was looking at the TV guide and he just happened to mention, and I didn't know this because it was a new TV guide. He happened to mention that that day, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein was on TV, and I screamed. I mean, screamed to the point where, you know, he got really mad at me. It didn't help that I broke all the windows in the house. So, but then, let's face it, the pain was gone. But you know, these crazy kids today with their long hair and modern dancing. And by the way, that original script that Fred and Robert and John Grant came up with also included The Mummy, Count Alucard, who was the son of Dracula. Alucard was Dracula spelled backwards. And The Invisible Man. And the only one to make that cut was The Invisible Man. Yeah. In a cameo, you know? I think it's one of the best performances I've never seen. Vincent Price, just great.
That makes me wonder, can you really call it a cameo appearance?
No,
since it's The Invisible Man, you know?
But I did notice, before I forget, I did notice one mistake in that thing. He's talking while he's lighting the cigarette.
Yes!
He couldn't talk like that if he were lighting a cigarette. So yeah, I thought that was interesting, along with the long shots of Bud and Lou's doubles in the boat. The, God forbid they should jump in the water, you know. We're giving away everything at the top. Okay, I do want to mention these things before we move on. Okay, so everybody sit down. We are doing a part two for this film, because it is the special one. And next week, I have a lineup of fans of the podcast who wanted to be part of this and discuss their love of this movie. And I do want to mention one special person, Perry Shields, who actually dressed and made up with prosthetics and everything as Jack Pierce, the great makeup man. And he did a one-man show about Jack Pierce. So he's going to be around to tell us all about the makeup and the transitions that they went through going from Jack Pierce to Bud Westmore, you know, all of that. So that's going to be part of part two, and that should be really good. I would love to get Joe Adamson. I mean, I think he would do it, but I'll check it out with him. He's not big on Abbott and Costello, but he often talks about his first movie experience, I think, was Keystone Cops.
Ah.
Yeah. So anyway, he might want to talk about that. Who knows? We'll see. All right. And I also want to mention, did I mention the score?
No, not yet.
Okay. Not yet. I want to mention that there was a Kickstarter campaign for Intrada Records. That's Intrada Records. And they recorded with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra the entire score of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Frank Skinner's amazing score, and Henry Mancini's score for Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. Ah. So I don't know about you guys, but that's what I'm going to be driving around listening to. I might even try stunts and, you know, jumping, you know, over cliffs and everything.
Just don't stall out on the railroad track. That's all I'm asking.
Oh, boy. And we're not even there yet. So, yeah. Okay. So let's get back to the film. After this wonderful, wonderful opening credits thing, we have the Frank Skinner score, which is just, can I say perfect? I just want to say perfect. It's one of the more perfect scores of all time. I have to say right now, my mom is in the other room watching Gone with the Wind, believe it or not. And I think that's the other one of the other perfect scores. It's just gorgeous. So we have that wonderful music, and we immediately cut to Universal stock footage of London. So you see, it's, you know, shots of London. There's Big Ben. There's a Bobby, you know, a cop walking by. Yeah. But then we go to the window of the hotel room of a very tormented Lawrence Talbot. Lawrence Talbot, otherwise known as the Wolfman, otherwise known as Lon Chaney Jr. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the cast. We did talk about Lon when we did Here Come the Coeds, because he was their enemy in that one. He was born in 1906. He was actually born dead. His father grabbed the baby, ran out to the frozen lake, broke through, and put the baby in the frozen water. And Lon came around. So his father saved his little life at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, talk about drama right from the start. So yeah, he grew up with a somewhat abusive father. He was not the most warm guy in the world. If you listen to Lon, it was a lot more serious than had you talked to somebody who worked with Lon Chaney Sr. And I do know a friend of mine, Douglas McEwen, his father, I believe it was, or his grandfather, worked at MGM with Lon, you know, as a behind the scenes, and said he was one of the nicest guys he'd ever met. So maybe he was, you know, there are people who go to work and they're popular and then they go home and beat their wives, you know? So how do we know? So Lon had a very troubled upbringing. His father did not want him to go into show business. So he got into the heaters, you know, like home heaters, that business. Not doing well. He drifted into the movie business after his father passed away in 1930. And eventually was forced to take his father's name. His name was Creighton Chaney. There's also the incident with his mother, Cleva Chaney, who was having trouble with Lon and who committed suicide off stage while Lon was on stage. She drank mercurochrome or something poisonous, and it ruined her complete career, her vocal cords and all that. She was, after the divorce, little Lon was told that his mother was dead. And when he found out later, that was quite a shock. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about a dramatic life. My God.
Yeah.
But anyway, he got into small roles. He played some Westerns, villain stuff, got signed by 20th Century Fox and did basically nothing. He was mostly in the background. And then he got cast in the Los Angeles production of Mice and Men. On Broadway, it was Broderick Crawford. But anyway, Hal Roach went to see the play and became enamored of Lon's performance and then cast him in the movie version, directed by Lewis Milestone, co-starring Burgess Meredith. And Lon is incredible. He's just incredible. I mean, I would have loved to have seen Broad Crawford do it. But interestingly, eventually at Universal, Broad Crawford and Lon Chaney shared a dressing room. And they would, like on Friday, after the week was finished, they would get completely loaded and beat each other up. Part of the budget to some of those films was redecorating their dressing room. Can you imagine? There's a great movie called North to the Klondike that has both of them. Lon is the villain, Broad is the hero. And the two of them have a knockdown, drag-out fight, no stuntmen. Then they're probably both drunk off their butts. It's some fight, let me tell you. It's great.
Are you sure they just didn't bring the camera into their dressing room one day?
It's supposed to be the Klondike. Well, maybe they turned up the air conditioning. Who knows? And there was a bar there, so it was the Klondike bar. So, that's pretty terrible. I'm sorry. So anyway, so we've got Lon. Let's just say he became a star thanks to Of Mice and Men, became Universal's, you know, youngest horror performer, created the Wolfman, and was the only person to play that character. But he did all the other characters. He did the Frankenstein monster. He played Dracula or Count Alucard, the mummy several times, which he hated. And eventually, you know, like I said, Universal dropped him, and he became a very, very capable freelance actor, making some nice films. High Noon, for one, he was terrific. The Defiant Ones, he's terrific. He's just terrific. Unfortunately, he ended up in grade Z horror films, you know, making a buck. That's about it. My only thing about Lon, and I have to chastise him for this, but he may have been drinking. I don't know, because he was quite the alcoholic. He blamed Bud and Lou on the demise of the monster movies. He said that they made a fool of the monsters. Blah, 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 blah. He's wrong. He was wrong.
Yep.
They treated them with nothing but respect. Mm-hmm. And the actors themselves, they treated with reverence. They really, really appreciated having them there, despite the fact that they apparently hated the script initially. You know what I'm thinking, Jerry? Because it never sat well with me that they read this script. First of all, reading the script. but it never sat well with me that they didn't like it. And they were so adamant about not doing it and hating it and all this stuff. Maybe they were looking at one of the earlier drafts, which they had every right to say those things about. You know what I mean?
Could be. Could be.
That's what I'm thinking. Because why else would they do that? And why else would they give such amazing performances in the film? So I don't know. That's another thing that might be thrown under the bus. So anyway, Lon passed away in 1973. It was a sad day. I used to keep his obituary up on my bulletin board in my bedroom. Mm. And we love Lon. Lon was a huge part of a lot of our childhoods.
Oh, yeah. First time I can remember seeing him and identifying him as Lon Chaney was actually on an episode of The Monkees.
Yes, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. He basically did Lenny.
Yes.
From Mice and Men. And it was just a wonderful, wonderfully delightful performance.
It's just great to see him in anything. And, you know, he did that Lenny character in a few movies. He does it in My Favorite Brunette with Bob Hope. I got the gun, you know. And let's face it, the characters in the Warner Brothers cartoons and the MGM cartoons, which way did he go? Which way did he go, George? Which way did he, you know? Yep. That's Lenny. They're doing Lenny.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't do that today.
No.
You know, mentally challenged.
Yep.
So we see Lon. Lon is making a long distance phone call, which was very expensive internationally in those days. And he calls a baggage room. What would you call that? The baggage room of a train station.
Yep.
And it is in a town where I did my very last play. 1776. That wasn't the year I did it. That was the play. And it wasn't the address of the theater. No, but that was the play I did, the last play. And that was in La Mirada, California. But anyway, this is La Mirada, Florida, which I don't know. I don't think it exists. Yeah. And who's working as baggage handlers and who do you want handling your delicate crates? Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. So Lou answers the phone. And Lon is just, you know, he's beside himself. He tells them that they're getting crates for the McDougal House of Horrors and that he needs to know that the Dracula is there and the Frankenstein monster is there. Anyway, a full moon comes out while he's on the phone and he transforms into the Wolfman while he's speaking with Lou long distance. Boy, talk about being far away. Anyway, I'm so sorry. I really am. And I mean that in every sense. So yeah, Lou accuses him of putting his dog on the phone saying, you're calling me long distance to talk to your dog. So anyway, he hangs up on him and that's that. So who shows up but Mr. McDougal himself to pick up his crates? It's the original Frankenstein monster and the remains of Count Dracula. Apparently, the little exchange they had when he said, I've been here 5 minutes. And he says, I've been here for 5 years. You know, what are you complaining about? That was added on the set. It wasn't in the original script. So they're playing around with Frank Ferguson, who I love. Frank Ferguson, let's talk about him a little bit. Frank Ferguson, born in 1899 in Ferndale, California. He earned his master's degree at Cornell University. He was one of the first directors slash actors at the Pasadena Playhouse, a very, very reputable place. He appeared in over 200 films and television shows, his first being Young Tom Edison at MGM in 1940, his last being The Great Sioux Massacre. He was quite versatile, actually. He was a tutor. Actually, an acting tutor for people we know, people like Dana Andrews and others. He was just fantastic, and he's wonderful in this movie. He's a great foil for the boys. So while he's frying an egg on his head, we meet our villainess, and I'm going to get a little crazy here because I've had a crush on her since I'm probably 3 years old. Nora Aubert is just one of the most gorgeous creatures, for me, this is my opinion, to step before a camera. And unfortunately, she didn't have a good time of it. Let's just mention dear Dr. Mornay. She was born in 1913, which means she was 35 when she made this film. Old by Hollywood standards. Mm-hmm. She was born in Slovenia, and she was picked up by Samuel Goldwyn's company to play a foreign spy in the Bob Hope movie, They Got Me Covered. I think that was 1943. And Sam Goldwyn wanted her as his mistress. She said no, and Sam said, you will never be a star. And she never was.
Oh.
In fact, she only made 16 films, not always great films, not always great roles. And he put the kibosh on her. Sam Goldwyn, God bless him. You know, anyone who needs to go to a psychiatrist should have his head examined. That's Sam Goldwyn. Anyway, so after her movie career petered out in the late 40s, in early 50s, actually, she went to New York City. And with her then husband, they started a garment shop in the garment district in New York. They divorced in 1956. Then she moved to Europe, did one film in 1951, eventually returned in 1959 with a new husband. She divorced him in 1974, had a terrible stroke in 1983, was in a home for quite a while. There's a sad story Gregory Mank told on the commentary for this movie, that somebody had come to visit her while she was convalescing and had a picture for her to sign. And he didn't look. He didn't look at it until he left. And written on the picture was, help. That's creepy.
Oh.
Yeah, that's pretty creepy. So the poor woman was there and passed away 10 years later after her stroke. In 1993. Okay, so we meet Dr. Sandra Mornay, and she is just head over heels with Wilbur Gray, Lou Costello. She towers over him, but she is just enamored beyond all belief. Bud can't fathom it, you know? What's the great joke? She cuts Bud down like that.
Get up out of there and go to work. That is, if your head doesn't bother you too much.
His head is all right.
It is, eh? But is your head all right?
Certainly.
Frankly, I don't get it.
And frankly, you never will.
Now that's a great line. That is a great line. And she says it beautifully. She's got a little sarcastic smile on her face as she says it. And I just want to mention that in the outtakes for this film, she seems to be having a very good time, and she and Lou get along very, very well. It's almost like, you know, they were having lunch together, you know? But yeah, it looks like she's having a great time. Later in life, she was bemused by the fact that this is what she was remembered for, as opposed to Jane Randolph, who plays the good girl, Joan, in this movie. She loved every minute of it. She said it was the most fun she ever had. So Sandra is coming on to Lou. Bud can't understand it at all. And she seems to be very concerned with his head. When he falls, he pulls the baggage out from the bottom, and all the baggage falls on him. She runs to him and checks his head. Does this hurt? Does this hurt? Why does she check his head? Well, the original title to this film, right up until just before they shot it, was called The Brain of Frankenstein. A comedy? Now, I forget who it is that came up with the idea of saying Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, but talk about brilliant. You know, it seems so simple, but this was a very early idea at this point, you know, to include their names along with the frightening part. So basically, the brain of Frankenstein was left behind, but they wanted Lou's brain to put into the monster's head because the monster was an uncontrollable, as Bela Lugosi says, brute, meaning brute. And so that's their plan. They're going to lure Lou to the island where they have their castle and their laboratory, which I'm sure nobody notices in the middle of the ocean there. It is a beautiful glass painting, though. It's just gorgeous.
It is.
And more animation work, you know, from the Dracula turning into, from a bat into Dracula himself. And back again in certain scenes.
Yep.
So anyway, we find out that that's what's going on. Mr. McDougal tells them that they have to deliver the packages to his House of Horrors, which is like a big wax museum, a horror wax museum. So Bud and Lou, on a stormy, dark night, wind up, right? Of course, that's the trope. wind up at McDougal's House of Horrors. My late friend, Michael Schlesinger, had that t-shirt, McDougal's House of Horrors. Yeah, I know. I want one too. Anyway, they get there and Lou is just really scared. You know, it's like, and Bud is like, can you believe people pay to get scared? You know, and Lou says, I'm cheating them. I'm getting scared for nothing. So they're there and they're unpacking and, you know, unloading. And they take Dracula's coffin out of the crate. And there are placards to read with the legend of, you know, like Dracula and the monster and all this stuff. So Lou has a candle. This is, okay, we're going back. This is one of the John Grant ingenious ideas, you know? I like it even better than the Hold That Ghost.
Yes.
Right? Because it gives it a reason. You know, there's a reason why that candle is moving. Basically, what we're talking about is Dracula is actually in the coffin. Lou puts a candle, a lighted candle, on top of the coffin so he could read the placard. And when Dracula opens the coffin, even slightly, the candle moves. So you see, it's got a reason. Yeah. And Lou, of course, is, you know, oh, chick. Wait, what is it? Trying to whistle. It's hilarious. It's just hilarious. Get in here on the O. But anyway, so Bud has to show him that, you know, that this Dracula thing is the bunk. And Lou, of course, tells him that that's what I'm trying to tell you. This is his bunk. So anyway, he goes off to open the crate for the monster. And this I always got a kick out of. Lou takes the crowbar, puts it on the crate, the top of the crate, to open it. And before he could, like, pull the crowbar down to open the crate, Dracula in the background is opening his coffin. So you hear, and Lou looks at the crowbar like, I didn't move it. How did it make that sound? It's really nice. It's really nice stuff and subtle. Mm-hmm. It's really, really nice. Yes. So this was the part when I was a child that I waited for, is they open up the Frankenstein crate and they're taking the Excelsior out, and or Lou takes the one that reveals the monster's face. And just to see it, you know, it's just, it gets your heart going, especially when you're a kid. It's just like, oh my God, that's the monster. So it was by some accident, he ruins one of the displays. In fact, it's the guillotine that cuts off a head, and he has to hide the head before Mr. McDougal and the insurance agent comes to inspect the crates. So Lou takes the head and he's going to throw it away somewhere, and he decides, I'll throw it in Dracula's coffin. He opens it up to throw it, and there's Dracula. And Dracula, with those wonderful hands of his, hypnotizes poor Lou. And Lou is standing there completely out of it. And he goes over to the monster. And he takes this, I always found funny, the ring that he puts on the posts, Frankenstein's or the monster's posts in his neck. And there's like an electrical charge.
Yeah.
It's like, what is that? Is that a thing where you shake hands with Dracula and he laughs? You know, like the like a practical joke. I fooled you.
You know, I always took that to be, you know, the ring was some kind of battery.
Yeah, you know? It had to be.
Yeah.
You know? There's even the animated, you know, electrical charge that
you see.
But anyway, we also learned that the monster speaks in this one. He's yes, master. Now let's go. I just want to go over quickly where we left the monster in the last incarnations, you know, at Universal. We had Lon Chaney in Ghost of Frankenstein. At the end of that movie, Igor, who is actually Bela Lugosi, arranges to have his brain put into the monster's head. And at the end, the monster is talking like Bela Lugosi. Before it's destroyed, of course, or we think it's destroyed. Next movie is Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And they actually got Bela to play the Frankenstein monster because he had dialogue. It was in the last movie, it was Igor, it was Bela Lugosi. Unfortunately, when they previewed the film, the voice coming out of the monster got laughs. It seemed funny. So poor Bela, they took away all his dialogue. So he's standing there in certain scenes talking and nothing's coming out. And he's blind. In Ghost of Frankenstein, we realized that the blood types were not the same and he goes blind. Oh. So Bela's walking around with his hands out, you know, with his eyes kind of closed, rummaging around because he's blind. But everybody looks at that performance as the worst monster performance in the series. And it's not Bela's fault. So I'm going to say that on Bela's behalf. So where does that leave us? They come back. Glenn Strange becomes the monster in House of Frankenstein. And then again in House of Dracula. And basically, he doesn't talk anymore. There's no indication of Igor's brain being there. Mm-hmm. And he's basically a prop in these movies. He doesn't have much to do. And usually comes around like at the last 10 minutes of the movie. So this one, he's talking again. And he doesn't sound like Bela. No. So it's kind of interesting. I kind of go back to the original, back to The Bride of Frankenstein, where he actually did speak.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that this is residual, you know, brain cells from that time, I guess. Yes, master. And Lugosi is just, yes. Oh, he's just great. He just, he's dripping with evil. All right. So he gets the monster up and he's taking him out. And as they walk past Lou, this is a one controversial thing, actually a couple, but this is the first one. The monster looks at Lou and recoils in horror. Oh! And Lugosi underneath his cape and definitely dubbed in at this point. Because my theory is that when he had the cape around his mouth, it was obscured. So they had to dub it in and it's a little awkward. But he says, oh, don't be afraid. He won't hurt you. They gave a joke to them and it becomes Young Frankenstein for a second.
Yep.
I really wish they hadn't have put it in, even though when I was a kid, I loved it. I thought it was so funny, but, and it's a clever joke, but it doesn't really belong, you know, it doesn't belong. I would have been happier had they just exited, you know?
Yeah.
So McDougal is up in arms. Both of his properties are gone. He paid a fortune for them and he has the boys arrested. So at this point, we have a scene that was added a good 3 weeks after they wrapped because they felt they needed it. The scene in the insurance office where we find out that Jane Randolph, who is the insurance lady, very pretty, the opposite of Lenore Aubert. She's blonde and fair, where Lenore is dark. And she is going to find out what happened. She's going to do her research. So Jane Randolph, pretty Jane Randolph, was born in 1914. So she was also like 34 years old at this point. She was born in Youngstown, Ohio, but grew up in a city that has probably my favorite name in any city, Kokomo, Indiana. She grew up there. She loved golf. She actually became an aviatrix. She learned to fly. She moved to Hollywood in 1939. Warner Brothers saw her modeling and signed her in 1941. Unfortunately, she only did like bit parts and, you know, they didn't take advantage of her at Warner Brothers, unless there's something I don't know about. But luckily, after she was dropped, RKO picked her up. And she played the movies that she's most remembered for. We mentioned Val Lewton earlier. She was in Val Lewton's classic, Cat People. She plays the ingenue in that and has two scenes that are still talked about today and emulated today by modern horror movies. The bus reaction. We know about that, Jerry, where she's walking down a dark street and she just knows somebody's following her. And she knows it's probably the cat. And she's walking and she's silent and she's walking and all of a sudden you hear the screech of bus brakes as it pulls up beside her. And it's a shock. To this day, you could be watching this, you know, almost a 100-year-old movie, 80, 90-year-old movie, and it will still scare you. That's the bus reaction. And the other big scene was her in the swimming pool. She went to her gym late at night and she takes a late night swim. And she's also confronted by the cat. Beautiful stuff. She came back for Curse of the Cat People, which is a completely different kind of movie. It's more of a fantasy like a fairy tale, but she's also wonderful in that. But this is the movie she's most remembered for, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and she loved that. She loved the idea of that. This was her last film before she married a very, very wealthy Spaniard, and they moved to France, and she would come back to Los Angeles every so often, but she was very, very rich and lived a wonderful, comfortable life for the rest of her life, and she spoke highly of Bud and Lou and the fun they had on the set. She passed away in 2009. Her real name, by the way, was Jane Roemer. Okay, we see Dracula, the bat, flying to the island where they have his castle. Or it's not his castle, this is Florida. There just happens to be a castle.
Yes.
Right off the coast of Florida. Yeah. La Mirada, Florida, which doesn't exist. And you see the bat flying in, and then the animation takes over. He becomes Count Dracula, and he knocks on the door. Mel Brooks would have made a joke about the knockers, the big knockers. Can you imagine? These are very big knockers. knockers of the night. What music they make. So the door is answered by Dr. Mornay, and they check out the monster who is hanging around in the backyard. They've got him laying down in a clump of like grass and bushes. So he's there, and the monster is very weak. And Lugosi, he's growing weaker. But this is where we find out about Sandra Mornay, Dr. Mornay. Apparently, she has a very checkered past, and they leave it to you to wonder what that is. Now, he mentions some very questionable experiments back in Europe, you know, that the authorities are still looking for you. Now, I'm thinking Nazi. I'm thinking she was with the Nazi regime and escaped to America. That's just my guess. That's what I always thought. And I always needed something really serious because she ends up very badly. I want to make sure she deserves it. So, yeah, there it was. She answers the door and she tells him about Lou, about Wilbur and Wilbur's brain and what they plan to do. He will obey you like a puppy, whatever. So anyway, we cut back to Bud and Lou. This is the next morning after they spent the night in jail. They were told that an attractive woman bailed them out. They assumed it was Dr. Mornay, that it was Sandra. But it turns out that it was Jane. It was Joan, actually, in the movie, the insurance lady. And she did it for that purpose, to find out where those crates are. But she plays up to Lou. Lou is like the chick magnet. And Bud can't understand it. It's like, what? This little ball of, you know, of Lou Costello is attracting these gorgeous women. So he's got two dates now. They're going to a masquerade ball that night. And now he's got two dates. And Bud is like, you know, glomming for one of them. You know, it's like, I'll take one off your hands, you know, whatever. Maybe we should play that dialogue.
Now you've got two dates. What about Sandra, you bigamist?
Sandra? I don't know. Joan is awful cute.
All right, you take Joan, I'll take Sandra.
Oh, Sandra sends me.
Well, then I'll take Joan.
Joan sends me, too.
Now listen, you sawed-off Romeo. In a minute, I'll send you.
You don't even appeal to me.
Look, Wilbur, we've always been pals, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. We've always shared and shared alike, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, look, let's be reasonable. Come on.
I've always shared with you.
That you have.
If I had two cigarettes, I'd give you one.
That's right.
And if I had two pair of shoes, I'd give you a pair.
Don't I know that?
And if I have two girls...
Well?
Why don't you light that cigarette, put on those shoes, and take a walk for yourself?
That's just what I'm going to do, but with you.
Okay, so we find out that, you know, of course, Lou wants both girls. He wants a menage a trois, as it were. And Sandra made sure to tell him to come to the island alone. And that's so they could subdue him and take his brain and, you know, whatever. With Lou, I don't think it would matter much. But so Lou doesn't listen, and he brings Bud along and Joan. So they're getting off the boat, and Bud again comes up to Lou. And then we should play this dialogue also. This is John Grant.
Now, look, you've got Joan and Sandra. You've got two girls.
How about the two girls we had last week?
All right, let's not talk about
it. You got a kick on them.
I'm not kicking.
You had the best-looking one.
So what?
Yours had teeth.
Look, Wilbur, yours had teeth, too.
Did you see that tooth?
Yes, I happened to see it.
Mine had so much bridge work, every time I kissed her, I had to pay toll.
What's the use?
All right. So after that visit with John Grant, they make their way up to the front door with the big knocker. And who answers the door this time but the other doctor? I forget his name. Dr. Boring.
I don't have it here either, yes.
Dr. Dull. Doctor. This is played by Charles Bradstreet. Now, good luck finding much on him. He did not make many movies. In fact, I think this was his second to last film. He was born in 1918 in Silver Ridge, Maine. He was a bartender in Los Angeles. When he came to Los Angeles, he was a bartender at this popular place for studio people and also a bouncer there. Now, he was signed by Harry Cohn at Columbia. They were going to give him a chance, but they canceled his contract almost immediately when Harry Cohn remembered that Charlie had thrown out his nephew one night out of the bar, and it was very bad. So his contract was canceled. But he knew Charlie Barton and said he did this role as a favor to Charlie, and he felt like it was a step backward for him. But how could you step backward from backward? I mean, it's just, he would have fallen off the precipice. But anyway, very boring. Got into real estate eventually, and he said he was offered the role of Tarzan at one point, and he turned it down, and that he was offered the lead in Gunsmoke, and he turned that down and stayed in real estate. And eventually in 2004, he died and actually is in real estate under a grave marker, which was also dull. Anyway, so they tell the doctor that they're there to pick up Sandra to go to the costume ball. And there is an immediate attraction between Dr. Dull and Joan, the insurance lady. You could see it. And Lou immediately pulls her close, you know, feeling threatened. But anyway, he says he's going to go get Dr. Mornay and blah, blah, blah. Dr. Mornay comes down and sees that Lou did not come alone, and she's angry. She's, oh, why did you do this? Why did blah, blah? So she says, okay, I have to go upstairs and do my makeup and everything. And she invites Joan to come up and do the same in her vanity room. So the two of them are there, and Bud is still trying to get one of the dates out of Lou. But more importantly, upstairs, Joan and Sandra are getting acquainted. One is in one part of the room and the other one is obscured in the other side of the room. And Sandra takes this opportunity to look in Joan's purse and find her credentials as an insurance investigator. And she knows exactly why she's there. In the meantime, there's a scene at this grand stairway in this beautiful castle set, you know, inside. And actually Sandra comes down with Bela, who's wearing a beautiful smoking jacket and looks, you know, so Dracula-like. And there's some wonderful dialogue here where Bela is talking about youth, the joy of youth. Let's hear that.
Didn't I hear that you were going to masquerade ball?
Well, yes, we have our costumes out in the boat.
Oh, you young people, making the most of life while it lasts.
Thank you.
Okay, and for, you know, you hardliners, there is a great outtake available here during this scene where Bela comes down the stairs. We have little Bobby Barber wearing a cape and a dark hat being very Dracula-like behind Bela, and Bela has no idea. And everybody's laughing, and Bela turns around and starts yelling at Bobby Barber. What are you doing? You shouldn't be doing this. And it cuts off, like right in the middle of that. Yep. So Bela took his work very seriously, you know, and English was his second language. So I suppose he was very sensitive about it. But it's a funny clip. So anyway, it turns out that Sandra takes Bela upstairs and tells him about Joan and that she's an insurance investigator and that she's not going to the costume party. Bela, on the other hand, wants to get things going. So he hypnotizes her. And this is where the second big mistake comes. And that is, what is the rule, Jerry, about vampires and mirrors?
They have no reflection in a mirror.
Absolutely. But in this movie, Okay, I want to say two things. Number one, yeah, they were completely off by doing this because we all knew that, you know, they don't show up in mirrors.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, it's such a good shot that I forgive. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's based in the reflection, mm-hmm. but you see them in the foreground. So you're getting two angles in one shot.
Yep.
And the other thing I love, and, you know, call me Mr. Pervert, but when he bites her, orgasm? I mean, really, seriously. Her eyes go up, and she has that really beautiful smile, and he's doing something there. She joins the realm of vampires with Dracula, and they end up all going to the costume party. So they're at the costume party, and of course, Bela goes as Count Dracula, so he gets to wear his clothes.
Yeah,
I actually love when they're in the operating room and everybody's dressed in doctor clothes and stuff, and there's Bela with his cape and his tuxedo. It's like the Dean Martin show, you know, Dean in a coal mine, but he'd be wearing his tuxedo.
Yes.
So they're at the costume party, and this is where everything goes crazy. Bela is coming on to Joan and wanting to hypnotize her as well, and is successful at that. And Sandra takes Lou off, you know, into the woods a little bit where there's a bench, and they sit there for a little love scene. And this is one of my favorite scenes. Again, there's some wonderful dialogue here, one that plays on Jack Benny's sponsor on the Jack Benny program, Lucky Strike Cigarettes. Why don't we play this? This is good.
Sandra, there's something strange about you. You're not yourself. Is there anything I can do to help?
Yes. I want you to go away with me to the island.
Just me and you?
Yes. I want to be the only one in your life. I want to be part of you. I want to be in your blood.
I think I know what you mean. Wouldn't you want a prettier fella than me?
No, I want no one but you. You are so full-blooded, so round, so firm.
So fully packed. And I want to stay that way. I stuck myself. I'm bleeding.
Let me see it.
There ain't enough there for the two of us. If that's what you're thinking.
I'll tell you what I'm thinking. Look into my eyes.
I'm afraid to.
There's nothing to be afraid of. Look. Deeper. Deeper. Deeper.
I look deep enough. I don't want to look anymore.
Of course you do. Don't you know what's going to happen now?
I'll bite.
Oh, no. I will.
So at that point, Lou becomes aware of Sandra's vampirism, or strangeness, you might say. And she runs away when she hears Bud and Lon running into the picture. So Lou is trying to tell them that she's different. This is really weird. But Dracula has already kidnapped Joan, and they're looking for Joan like crazy. They don't know where she is. And the three of them split up into the forest and start yelling for Joan. While Lou is walking around looking for Joan, and Bud is off on another section, a full moon comes up. And Lon is with them, of course, and he falls down and becomes the Wolfman. I did want to mention that opening scene, the first transformation in his hotel mm-hmm. room in London, they shot it in 3 days. 3 days to do that. And I mean, this was with the simplified makeup. It just took forever. But then they weren't happy with it, and later, when the movie was almost wrapped, they went back and did it again. You wonder why Lon drank, you know? Yeah. And this one was tough. A lot of the crewmen, the makeup people, talked about how he had to just be there, you know, and he got a little drunker with each tuft of hair glued to his face. He would get a little bit more drunk. But anyway, so he turns, and they do a version. And this is John Grant again. In the naughty 90s, they did the version where Bud is supposed to dress up like a bear so Lou could look like a hero. And then a real bear shows up and Lou mm-hmm. is, you know, hitting him on the nose and all this stuff. Well, it turns out that Bud had a wolf mask And when Lou sees the Wolfman, he thinks it's Bud. And that's why he keeps hitting him and, you know, whatever. But I don't really buy this scene. I don't know. This is the one weak scene for me because he would never hit Bud like that. It stretches credulity here.
Yeah.
And just for the comic effect. And I don't really buy it. So, but I am forgetting the most famous joke in the movie. I sloughed right by the fact that they run into McDougal again, and McDougal throws Lou against a wall. He's so angry. And Bud said, "That's it, McDougal. We're going to sue you for everything you got." And McDougal's like, "You can't prove I did anything. Get out of here." So he asks a guy who's wearing a suit of armor to watch as he throws Lou against the wall again. And of course, the headpiece comes down just as Lou is being thrown, and he doesn't see it. So anyway, they go into the changing room and Lon shows up and Bud shows Lon his wolf mask. And Lon says, "Please don't wear that mask. Please. I never told you this, but whenever the moon is full, I turn into a wolf." And Lou, in one of the most perfect deliveries I've ever heard of a joke, he says, "You and 20 million other guys." And the timing and everything about that joke is just so memorable and so perfectly played. Yep. So anyway, I think that's the memorable joke of the entire movie. In fact, that's everybody loves that. So anyway, they're looking for Joan. Lon turns into the Wolfman. He attacks Mr. McDougal off camera. We don't see it. We just hear McDougal screaming. As everybody gathers around McDougal, we see Joe Kirk is there playing probably the smallest role he's ever played in an Avatar movie. Right? He's got two lines and that's it. And he's got that stupid costume on. but anyway, when Bud shows up with his wolf mask, they assume it was him that attacked McDougal. And then Lou shows up and points to Bud and says, "Why were you trying to kill me before?" You know, thinking he was the Wolfman. So everybody's after Bud. So it becomes a big chase and Bud has to run for his life. It's almost like a lynching party. So he's running. Lon is out there. Lou is running. You know, they're all trying to hide from this angry mob. And as they're trying to get away, Dracula shows up and hypnotizes Lou to get into the boat with Joan, who's also hypnotized. And then Bud shows up and Dracula hypnotizes him as well, but Bud just falls back into a faint. And he takes Lou and Joan to the island, to the castle. The next morning, Bud wakes up and Lon, they run into each other. They're both being pursued and you hear the dogs in the background and all that, and they've got to save Lou and Joan. So they get into a little boat and they go to the island to do that. Now, what's going on the island? Lou is in some sort of, it's like a stockade, I suppose, without the hands. You know, it's not the thing where you put your head and hands through. It's a stockade that locks around your neck and it's there holding you. So your hands are free, but you're subdued at the neck.
Yeah.
So he's up against a wall, subdued at the neck, and he sees the monster sitting, you know, dormant a few feet away. And Sandra, who is still under Dracula's spell, is standing there completely, you know, hypnotized. So Lou is like, "Sandra!" This is so memorable from childhood because we used to imitate it all the time. "Sandra Junior! Sandra Junior!" Now, why would he call the monster Junior? You think he'd call Lon Chaney Jr. But, but really, why would he? We always found that very funny. You know, Junior? Don't let him do it to you, Junior. I've had this brain for 35 years and it hasn't worked right yet. actually, he was 42 at the time.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, they take the monster to the operating room after dropping off Dr. Dull. they knocked him out and, you know, they threw him into a dungeon or something. But anyway, they take the monster out and that gives Lon and Bud a chance to come in and save Lou. Now, here's the other mistake that just drives me nuts. And I only noticed it recently. One of my favorite scenes is when Bud comes to save Lou to take him out of that, you know, the neck thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really long piece of wood that, you know, is up against his neck. Yeah. So Bud is trying to break the lock with a large rock. It is hitting the lock. And at one point, he puts it down. But he doesn't put it down naturally right next to where he's working. He looks at Lou. He looks at Lou's hand and actually places it there. Whereas he was not supposed to look, and he was supposed to put it there by accident.
Yeah.
So I always loved, I never noticed that when I was a kid or in subsequent screenings. And I always thought it was so funny that it's on Lou's hand and Bud won't do anything, you know, and he's hurting it, you know, it really hurts. But the thing is, Bud didn't do that very well. In fact, if I were Charlie Barton, I would have done a retake.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, that's here nor there. We're talking about something that happened 80 years ago. I can't be everywhere. So they get Lou out, and I think the most quoted thing from the movie that we did as children when we got together in school the next day, Lou running through the tunnel trying to get away and turning to Bud, and Bud saying, "Go to the left." And he looks at his left hand, turns, and runs right into a wall. We love that when we were kids, and we used to imitate it all the time. I think that's where I learned how to do the wall hit, you know, the Lou Costello wall hit. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's so funny. And he comes out saying, "No door." Lou's like, "Get out of here." I mean, Bud. So anyway, they're free now, and they've got to save everybody. So this leads to one of the most, if not the most perfect chases at the end of any comedy ever made. It's running through the castle. It's Dracula and the Wolfman fighting each other, going from room to room, the monster chasing Bud and Lou. But let's get to this, the examination scene. Lou is captured again. He is hypnotized by Dracula as he's trying to get the boat ready so they can all escape. And there was a gag, a very expensive gag they were supposed to do at this point. And basically it was Lou heading towards the boat, Dracula being kind of far away, stopping him, and Lou saying, "I'm not coming back," but with a conveyor belt hidden by the audience, Lou would go really fast back to Dracula. So they were looking at it as like a Buster Keaton type sight gag, you know, but they didn't do it. I think they were afraid of going over budget. And unfortunately, that's the problem. Even though this was the second cheapest movie Universal made that year, the cheapest being Feudin', Fussin', and a Fightin', starring Donald O'Connor.
However, I think what they ended up with, it's one of my favorite moments in the film, because Lou, under hypnosis, is responding, and he turns to go back into the cave, just kind of shuffling along. And then all of a sudden, he starts skipping like a little kid, skipping down the path back into the cave.
Apparently, that was his idea. I love that too, actually. Yeah. Like I don't need the other gag. I love that. It's like hypnosis brings out the real him, you know?
Yes.
And he would skip.
Yep.
That's funny. I like that. By the way, I'm looking at my notes here, and I forgot to mention that Dr. Mornay originally was supposed to be played by Patricia Morrison, who was under contract at the time and did the Sherlock Holmes movies and stuff. I got to meet her when she was almost 100 years old, and I had just watched her in, I forget which one, the Sherlock Holmes, Dressed to Kill, maybe? I forget. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I got to tell her I watched it, and she was very amused. She laughed. She did not take this role because she went into a little thing called Kiss Me, Kate on Broadway. I don't know whatever became of it, but, you know, she was Kate in Kiss Me, Kate.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm glad she didn't get the role because she's not as sexy as Lenore Robert. And another thing I wanted to mention, in the hotel room where Bud and Lou are after they get out of prison, right?
Yep.
They're getting ready for bed at one point before Lon comes in.
Yes.
But Bud is making up the couch. Does that mean Lou has the bedroom? What sort of world is this?
Well, exactly. You know, I had never noticed before, literally till this last viewing, that he was making up the couch.
The couch.
And that just got me thinking, okay, they can only afford a one-bedroom place, so someone's got the couch.
But yeah, it's Bud making up the couch. You would think if Lou was going to be sleeping there, Bud would have him do it.
Right, but right. Bud would take the bed and the couch.
Yes, you know? But then in the morning, Lou is folding up the blanket.
Yeah,
you know, as
yeah.
they're getting ready to leave. So yeah, I don't know.
Maybe the natural way of things took over, and we didn't get to see it. You know, what are you doing? Get off that bed. He changed his name to Bed Abbott. Okay. So Lou is on the operating table. And this, you know, when you talk about when this movie was released, they got a lot of complaints from mothers who sent their kids to see the latest Abbott and Costello movie. And the kids were petrified. You know, think about it. Back in 1948, they were petrified. This is the part that gets me when he says, "Can I please have a little ether?" And she says, "You won't need it. This will all be over in a few moments." And she's got the scalpel and she's measuring his where she's going to cut his head open. That was scary to me. And it's still scary to me.
Yes.
And it's so cruel. It's so this is where she gets what she deserves. You know what I mean? That's a very Nazi-like thing to do. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's what happens. He's on the operating table, and just before she makes the cut, they burst into the room, Bud and Lon, to save Lou. Okay, Dracula is not there yet. He's out of the room, and Lon starts untying or unbuckling the straps that Lou is held down by on the operating table. And as he's doing it, this is just brilliant. Mm-hmm. As he's unbuckling him, he looks up, and what's coming through the window but the full moon? And his hands change. And you don't see them change, but they're there. They're furry. And the camera moves up, and there he is in full Wolfman mode. And I'm sure Lon was thrilled not to have to sit through the transformation on this one. And I'm going to leave all the makeup talk till our next episode, where Perry Shields gives us the real lowdown. Okay, so here's what happens. Dracula breaks in, sees what's happening, and Bud, he's going to hit Dracula with a chair. And as he brings it back, he actually hits Sandra, Dr. Mornay, and she falls down, you know, somewhat out of consciousness. So Dracula and the Wolfman leave, with the Wolfman chasing Dracula, and the two of them are fighting. It's a fight to the death, the two of them. Bud unbuckles Lou as Sandra gets up, and the monster breaks out. He breaks his buckles. "Well, break my buckles." Doesn't the Wizard of Oz say that? So anyway, the monster comes up and he grabs Sandra and picks her up and throws her out of a window.
Yes.
Now, I'm the type of sensitive guy, and I was a sensitive kid, that would not stop it there. I imagined her falling and hitting like the rocks below this beautiful, beautiful woman. And it just terrified me. It was a really, really scary thing to do, especially in an Abbott and Costello movie. But considering what she was doing and who she was, I guess, you know, that was her comeuppance.
Yep.
But boy, it's really shocking. So what happens here? Glenn Strange picked up stuntwoman Helen Thurston, threw her through the window. She's on a wire. Unfortunately, it bounces back and she comes flying back into the room. Glenn, trying to be a gentleman, catches her so she won't hit the floor. But in doing so, he trips over a cable and fractures his ankle. But I got to tell you, Glenn was Trooper Plus, because later that night, he shot the scenes where he was throwing the barrels off the dock at the boys, you know, when they're trying to get away.
Yeah.
He did all of that with a fractured ankle. So Lon Chaney, wonderful Lon Chaney, speaks up and says, "Don't worry. You don't have to wait 3 days for him to recover. You know, you're going to lose a lot of money. I'll get into the makeup and I'll do it." And sure enough, and you could tell the difference,
yes.
the way they move more than anything, he becomes the monster at that point. And throws Sandra out of the window, turns around, and lunges at the boys. I think it was his lunge hour. And they start the chase. And the chase is just incredible.
Yes.
The monster chasing them from room to room in the castle. At one point, Lou was standing off his mark as the monster punches through the door and actually hit Lou.
Yes!
They left it in. It's there. And trooper that he was, you know, he just carried on. The funny part about this, and one of the funniest parts, is that every room they go into, all of a sudden, the Wolfman and Dracula come crashing into the room, you know, throwing vases at each other. And, you know, Dracula's got a chair trying to hold him back, you know, like a wild animal. So anyway, this is going on back and forth. Finally, and here's the other mistake. There's a couple left. Dracula turns around, throws his last vase at the Wolfman, like it's going to do anything, right?
Yeah.
And he turns around and turns into a bat. Just as the Wolfman comes and grabs Dracula as the bat, and they both fall to the watery rocks below. Actually, they fall into the water below. If you know your Universal Monster lore, you can only kill the Wolfman with a silver bullet.
Yes.
Or, from what I understand, decapitation. The only way to kill Dracula is with a stake through the heart or exposure to sunlight. Falling in the water? Maybe they were expecting another sequel. Who knows? I really don't know. But we have to assume that they're both dead, and that's that. In the meantime, Frankie Jr. is still chasing Bud and Lou throughout the house. And finally, they make it outside, and the monster is in hot pursuit. And, I forgot the one gag, the other one we used to imitate all the time when we were kids, when Lou takes the tablecloth from the table, and he does the trick where nothing falls off the table, and he turns around for a split second and almost takes a bow in front of us.
Yes.
He completed the trick. It's really a precious moment. And he runs into the room with Bud and closes the door. The monster follows, and the door opens, and there's Lou with the tablecloth, which is black, over his face like Dracula. And he's doing the hand stuff, going back, and the monster goes back and says, "Yes, master." And Lou at that point blows it by saying, "How do you like that? He thought I was Dracula." And that ruins everything. So anyway, they're running out of the castle, the monster in hot pursuit. I love the shot of him knocking the gates over, the big iron gates. And Bud and Lou get into a little rowboat that's tied up to the dock. Now, Lou forgets to untie the boat. So there they are there while the monster is on the dock throwing these huge barrels at them. You know, it's like he's trying to kill them, and they're not far away. You know, they're right there. Lou is trying to paddle away with his hand. You know, it's like, Bud is, untie the boat, will you please? So Lou finally unties the boat, and Dr. Dull, Charles Bradstreet, gets the idea. He's still on the island with Joan, who, when Dracula died, she came out of her spell. So she's fine. Mm-hmm. So he takes gasoline. There are cans of gasoline there, which I imagine, seriously, I thought about this. Why would there be cans of gasoline? Because they had a speedboat.
Yep.
They had a boat and they needed gas. So anyway, he pours the gas onto the dock. He lights it, and the monster turns and sees him and starts walking towards him. But he has to walk through the fire. This is where we switch to that dummy. And I don't mean Lou, he's still in the boat. But the monster starts walking through the fire overtakes him, and he falls through the dock into the water. I don't know what they had against water. But they were not, it didn't kill the monster. The monster had to be dissected. It was the only way you could kill him. So anyway, they were hoping that nobody remembered this and that it was, you know, a logical ending for the monster to burn and then fall. Okay, this takes us to the little boat that they finally untied. You know what? Let's play this, because I'd just love to hear the way Bud pronounces the word monster.
And another thing, Mr. Chick Young, the next time that I tell you that I saw something when I saw it, you believe me that I saw it.
Oh, relax. Now that we've seen the last of Dracula, the Wolfman and the monster, there's nobody to frighten us anymore.
Oh, that's too bad. I was hoping to get in on the excitement.
Who said that?
Allow me to introduce myself. I'm the Invisible Man.
Monster! Now that we've heard of Dracula and the monster... And the great, wonderful Vincent Price showing up at the end.
Yes, or not actually, showing up, as the case may be.
Not showing up. Actually, not showing up. smoking his little cigarette. But he was in The Return of the Invisible Man in 1940, I believe it was. And he was excellent. He was just excellent. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to see he could do this role and he was available for it because it's an amazing ending and so clever.
And his voice is so distinct. Mm-hmm. You know, they could have had just anybody deliver the line, but it was Vincent Price, and you knew it was Vincent Price.
Yes, but I wonder what would have happened if they went to Claude Rains, or if they did go to Claude Rains, who said no.
Ooh.
Because even when they made Abbott and Costello meet the Invisible Man in 1951, there was a picture of Claude Rains in the laboratory.
Yes.
So I don't know. It could have been. That's speculative. But the ending is the Invisible Man is there in the boat with them. They jump out of the boat and start swimming away. Of course, it's their doubles swimming away, which I never realized until recently.
Yeah.
So that is the end of what I consider to be one of the more perfect movies of all time. Other than those slight things that I mentioned, you know, that may cause people who've seen the movie 1,000 times to comment, it is just a near perfect film. And I have to say that in my movie history, and I am a film historian, I am a film buff, this movie is the one I've seen more than any other in my lifetime. I've probably seen it well over 100 times. The other ones are The Godfather and Godfather 2 and Duck Soup with the Marx Brothers. I think I've seen that, you know, maybe just a little less than this one. So this is it. This is the movie that Abbott and Costello are going to be and are remembered by, even by the people that are not that crazy about their films. But this is it. And I want to tell everyone that it's available on Blu-ray as a single offering. It's also part of the Abbott and Costello Universal Collection on Blu-ray and also just on DVD. And it's in all of the monster collections, the Wolfman, mm-hmm. Dracula, and Frankenstein. It's offered on all of those as well. So you really, it's also showing on my microwave right now as I speak. It's harder to avoid this film than it is to actually see it. But I, ladies and gentlemen, and I use that term loosely, I recommend this more than, seriously, more than most films out there. Mm-hmm. It is, you want to have a good time? Sit down with your kids and watch it and watch the reaction. Yeah. Sit down with a crew of Korean sailors and see what they think of it. It is just, it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful. And I can't say enough about it. As far as my writing partner, Matthew, is concerned, you have an open invitation to our next episode, which is people talking about the film itself and what it means to them. So I would love to have you aboard so you could tell everyone and give us an opportunity to lacerate you. I'm kidding. So anyway, that is that. Jerry, this has just been a joy. Thank you
always.
So much. Once
always,
again.
Always, 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 yes.
Yeah, and this one especially. And mm-hmm. remember, the next one, kids, we're going to have about 5 or 6 people who listen to this podcast on a regular basis, and they all want to share their feelings about this movie. And again, like I said, my friend Perry Shields, who is a wonderful director, actor, and teacher, he actually did a one-man show as Jack Pierce, the great makeup man, and he knows all about this. So we'll find out all about that. And in the meantime, Jerry, I will see you in 2 weeks. I will be out of town, but I will be doing it from a buddy's place out of town. So, but I will be here.
You'll be doing it on location. Okay.
On location. Yes. In Transylvania.
I wonder if you'll sound any different, but there you are.
I am. Okay. You know, when I am there, I tend to talk like this. I don't know why, but that's the way I talk. I suddenly become Harvey Firestein. don't ask me why. But anyway, we will do it from there. And Jerry, I will get you the names and addresses of the people that are going to be on the show. And we're going to have a big time, a big old time. I'm trying to decide, and I'm going to confer with you about this, Jerry, whether we should have this as a video one. So we could see all the people.
Ooh.
And it might be, you know, a little easier for the people because I'm going to do my old, you know, raise your hand before you speak, because there's going to be a lot of people. Yeah. All right, let's go. Let's let these people go. Let these people go. All right, everybody, you take good care of yourselves, and I'm wishing you all the best, lots of happiness, and watch Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. You'll feel better, I promise you. Right, Jer?
Definitely.
Bye-bye, everybody.